From time to time, I have occasion to visit Dr. Ramesh, a dentist in Salem, in South India, who's a very nice gentleman. He treats all kinds of sadhus free. And like many Hindus, educated Hindus especially, he keeps in his house, or well, actually, I've not been in his house, in his chamber, dentist's clinic, a statue of Buddha Dev, and he's fond of saying that everything is energy, which is a common perspective of people who read a certain genre of popular science books, of which I guess the first was The Tao of Physics by Fritjof Capra, which was, maybe that went back to the 1970s. Still, the idea is there. Well, it comes from this idea that, well, ultimately, what are we talking about? Atoms. There aren't really atoms. There aren't really even electrons. It's all waves. Everything is energy, which from a material perspective, from the current perspective of science, physics, can be said to be correct, I suppose. What do I know about all these things? I did read The Tao of Physics a long time ago. But it does beg the question, if everything is energy, what is the source of that energy? When we see energy, or when we perceive energy, there's always a source. And when we say energy, well, the energies interact. And what causes that? What's going on behind it all? This is a question which brings in the spiritual perspective. We find in Bhagavad Gita that there is energy, certainly, and Krishna is behind all energies. Bhumirapo nalo vayo kang mano buddhiri vacha ahankara iti yangme bhina prakriti ashtadha. There are eight basic kinds of energy, Krishna says. They're all Krishna's energies. The word used here is prakriti, nature, which is can also be understood as energy, shakti. Oh, yeah, so the eight aspects are earth, water, fire, air, ether, mind, intelligence, and false ego. Then Krishna goes on to say in the next verse, aparayam itastranyang prakritiṃ vidhi me param jiva bhutam mahabaho yayedam dharyate jagat. But there is another kind of energy, Krishna says. Again, the energy is Krishna's energy, he claims. Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. There's another energy which causes all these material elements to interact with each other. When we say material elements, we're not particularly thinking about the periodic table. It's a different way of looking at matter altogether. there's another energy, a superior energy, which is the spiritual nature of all the living beings, which make the jagat, gachatiti jagat, that which moves. What makes it move? What makes everything move is the spiritual energy of the living beings, and ultimately behind them, shakti, shakti mata, abheda. The possessor of the energy and the energy are in one sense non-different, just like we cannot conceive of the sun without the sunlight, or the sunlight without the sun. They're absolutely and intrinsically interlinked, but still the sun is the source of the sunlight. So in the same way, there is energy, for sure. If you say everything is energy, We don't have a problem with that, but we would like to add a further qualifier, or an essential qualifier, that there's the source of the energy also. And ultimately the source of the energy, although the energy and the energetic are intrinsically and inextricably related, still the sun, as the source of the sun rays, is more important. The sun rays depend upon the sun, not that the sun depends upon the sun rays. From a spiritual perspective, we have Sarvam Kalvidam Brahma, Chandogya Upanishad, I believe that is. Everything that we see here is Brahma. So the not the Tao perspective, but the Vedanta perspective is that everything here is Brahma, which is generally conceived of by the followers of the impersonal Vedanta, Advaita Vedanta. Yeah, it is conceived of as being a oneness. And it's not even really energy. It's just a oneness of existence. When there's only oneness, there's no energy within it. But this is how the followers of the Advaita path see it. From the Vaishnava perspective, and these are all different perspectives, and it's not wrong to say that everything is energy. It's not incorrect. What Dr. Ramesh says is not correct, but we can bring that up to another level, that there is material energy and there is spiritual energy. And we can take that up to another level and say, well, there's a higher source of all the energy. So everything is energy, yes, true. But we have to see the energetic, who is not different from the energy also. This is Vedanta philosophy, Vaishnava Vedanta, especially Gaudiya Vaishnava. And Gaudiya Vaishnava puts much stress on rasa, that everywhere there is rasa, what propels energy, ultimately living source, what is it that propels interaction? That is discussed in the preface to the Nectar of Devotion by His Divine Grace Srila Prabhupada, that it's love that motivates us. So rasa means an exchange between discrete individual sources of energy or loci of energy, living beings, exchanges, energetic exchanges between them, which produce emotions. And ultimately, it's all love. Homo scientificus, if there is such a thing. We have Homo sapiens, and it's supposed to be sapient to have a scientific outlook, stresses so much on the technicalities. We want to understand how these different energies are interacting from the scientific standpoint. We want to understand it logically, which becomes very difficult when you get deeper and deeper and deeper into it. The general attempt of scientists, I'm speaking in a very general way, is to deny the spiritual or to try to explain it in terms of the material. Well, everything's all energy, so what you see as spiritual is also material. And there's one big question which the scientists don't seem to ask themselves at all, or if they ask it, again, they try to explain it in material terms, is that what is the consciousness by which we experience everything, and although they try to explain this in material terms, that, well, consciousness is manifested within the brain. I try to explain it on terms of neurology. Consciousness is manifested in the brain, so it must be just some interaction of chemicals. But chemicals aren't conscious. This is a big question that no one seems to be asking in the great debate about evolution, although the way many scientists speak is not really a debate at all. Evolution of life from chemicals is just a fact as far as they're concerned. But my question is, well, what is it that impels chemicals to want to survive? If we say the human body or the mosquito body or the plant body is alive, what is it that we say the struggle for the survival of the fittest? Well, why should chemicals want to survive? The Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, the definitive treatise on rasa, this emotional experience, says that just as the, or it gives the idea that just as the sun and the sunshine is intrinsically dependent on the sun, so the nature of conscious living beings is not simply to be aware and to be conscious, but to want to exchange ultimately love and all kinds of various emotions. And actually, although we try to be very scientific and treat everything in a very detached way, but we are also emotional beings. We're more emotional beings than technical. Scientists are, although they swear by the empiric method or the detached method, they're also biased. Thomas Kuhn notably pointed that out. Importantly pointed it out, but they don't seem to believe that. They're also human beings, and they have their emotions also, that we all latch onto some particular worldview, and then we want to support it. It's not just that, not the scientists who support evolutionary theory or oppose it are necessarily just in a completely detached manner examining the facts and drawing conclusions, but they're emotionally attached to upholding the validity, as they see it, of evolutionary theory, or debunking it. Now, if you say that we used to hear that everything is just chemicals. Now everything is energy. So the consciousness, it's energy that the different neurons fire within the brain. And then the electrical exchange in certain neurons, which themselves, if you break them down, go deeper and deeper into their structure, there is no real structure per se. It's all just waves, not particles. But we don't live like that, and we can't live like that. If we, a science student male is attracted to a science student female, and they don't get together and say, well, my neurons are firing in such a way that I feel attraction for you. He doesn't even want to think about that. Well, we tend to think of scientists as being very not necessarily hard, but somewhat cold and stolid. But they're also human beings, and they also have relationships, and they also want someone. you need somebody to love. They also have their wives and children, but they don't behave with their wives and children as if they're wives and children or their husbands and children. Sorry for the sexist language. If their husbands and children are just particular matrixes of energy, they treat them with affection, we hope. Of course they do. And they don't want to think, well, these children are just some blobs of energy, which I, another blob of energy, observe through my eyes, and due to some kind of energies, I feel something called affection and love for my children, which isn't really real. They don't think like that. They don't even want to think like that. What is that affection? That is rasa. So our proposition, everything is energy, okay, all right, accepted at some level, but if we come higher, 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 everything is rasa. Everything we experience, all our experiences, everything we do gives rise to rasa, everyone we interact with, there's an emotional content. Look, I'm going like this, as if it's in my brain. It's not just in the brain. There's an emotional content. The Gaudiya Vaishnavas want to tell us that this rasa, this is the ultimate reality that we should be seeking. And everyone is, even if they talk in terms of cold, hard science. Everyone seeks rasa, especially in the human form of life. That exchange, where in Krishna consciousness, Gaudiya Vaishnavism, we don't want to just reduce everything to energy. Philosophically, yes, not forgetting, and especially stressing, the source of all energy, but we don't want to reduce everything simply to energy and leave it at that. We want to stress that our real selves are driven by the energy of love. Don't reject it because you can't define it scientifically, or you think you can define it in terms of neurological functions. Love is real. We're not just chemicals or conglomerations of particles. We're living, loving beings. Whether you take it from the approach that, well, everything is all energy, waves, various waves which make up the universe, or you take the approach everything is rasa, the source, there's a source for everything. That is Krishna. Krishna is interested in energy. He speaks about his energies. I quoted that from Bhagavad Gita. Parasya shakti vividhaiva shruyate swabhavaki jnana bala kriyacha. The Upanishads describe that he is the independent, self-sufficient source of all energies. The energies work as if independent of him. In other words, the energies are set up so nicely, he doesn't have to personally supervise them all the time. So he is the source of all energies, no doubt. But at the same time, the thing which he personally is most interested in is rasa. Personally, yes, he's a person. The source of energy, everything is a person, the Supreme Person, Krishna. We're talking about love. Love is maybe a concept, but it is shared between living beings. There can be negative emotions also. The flip side of love is hate. The flip side of trust is fear. There can be negative emotions also. Krishna is the source of and the center of all emotions. In this regard, there's a verse, very astonishing verse, charming verse, fascinating, that's the word, a fascinating verse in the Srimad Bhagavatam, which describes that when Krishna entered the wrestling arena in Mathura for the wrestling match organized by Kamsa, different people saw him in different ways. He was the same Krishna, but different people according to their own mentalities in relation with Krishna. Or maybe they didn't want to have a relation with Krishna, but there was Krishna. And different people saw him in different ways. And that's described by Vyasadev in Srimad Bhagavatam as follows. I'll read the Sanskrit. Malanam ashanenirnam naravara strinam smaro murtiman gopanam svajano satang shitibhujang shasta svapitro shishuhu mrityur bhojapate virada vidusham tatvang param yoginam Vrishinam paradevate ti vidito rangam gata sagrajaha. Translation. The various groups of people in the arena regarded Krishna in different ways when he entered it with his elder brother. The wrestlers saw Krishna as a lightning bolt, figuratively. The men of Mathura as the best of males, the women as Cupid in person, the cowherd men as their relative, the impious rulers as a chastiser, his parents as their child, the king of the Bhojas as death, the unintelligent as the Supreme Lord's universal form, the yogis as the absolute truth. They didn't really want to have Krishna personal relationship with him, but just, okay. Is the absolute truth, and the Vrishnis as their supreme worshipable deity. Of course, one has to go through a lot of preliminary study and training in the teachings of the Srimad Bhagavatam to come to the point of being able to understand what's going on here, the description of superficially, the story is not difficult to understand. Krishna is a young boy who's entered a wrestling arena. But to understand the underlying psychology expressed in terms of rasa, rasa emotive experiences, which give mostly give pleasure, some don't give pleasure, just the opposite. to understand all this, it requires quite a lot of study. The commentator, Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti, points out that people like the wrestlers and like Kamsa and the other, the supporters of Kamsa, the impious kings, they saw Krishna as being dangerous, angry, or threatening because they failed to understand the actual position of Krishna as the Supreme Personality of Godhead. That's why to understand Krishna as the Supreme Personality of Godhead really comes first before to understand that he's the source of all energies, the overseer of all energies, the supreme controller, God in one short and often misused and misunderstood English word. That is required first of all. And then gradually we can come to the level of understanding and entering into the emotive experiences directly in relation with him. Though if we don't understand who he is, we'll find him to be threatening, angry, dangerous, and Many people deny the existence of God at all. It's dangerous to them, or revolting. They find it revolting, or they dismiss it as foolish. It's not very... If we take it objectively, it's not a very intelligent response, although those who pride themselves on being realists, they think themselves most intelligent. In this regard of this verse which I just read, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati Thakur quotes from the Vedas, Taittiriya Upanishad, Rasa Obhaya Saha. Rasanghi evayang ladvanandi bhavati. He, Krishna himself, is rasa, because the energy and the source of energy, they're ultimately non-different. So that experience we have in relationship with Krishna, or with others also, which is called rasa. Krishna is the fountainhead of all rasas, and he's non-different from that. One who achieves this rasa, or who enters into the realm of the arena of transcendental, developed rasa based on, or derived from purity, based on pure love, they become anandi, labdva anandi bhavati, they become full of bliss. In this regard, Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati Thakur quotes in his comment on this verse from Rupa Goswami, the definition of rasa, attempting to define. It's very difficult to define, but this is a definition. Vyatitya bhavana varma yas chamatkara bharabhuhu hridi satvojvale bardhang svadatte saraso mataha. That which is beyond imagination. So there you go, immediately. We're trying to define it, and immediately define it, well, can't really define it at all. It's beyond imagination. It's heavy with wonder. It invokes wonder within our hearts and is relished in the heart, in a heart which itself is resplendent with goodness. That is called rasa. Well, it might have given us some kind of idea of how to begin to understand it. And some things you can try and analyze, just like what is the taste of honey? What is the taste? Of course, there are so many varieties of honey. What is the taste of any particular honey? You can analyze it. You could even analyze using fMRI scans the various parts of the brain which respond when someone is tasting that honey, but to actually experience it is something which the individual has to do. And he can explain it. It's sweet, and then just try and explain exactly what is the difference in flavor between one variety of honey and another. Clover honey and wild forest honey. And it's hard to say. Maybe if someone took some training in honey tasting, they could do. But otherwise, it's hard to explain exactly what is the difference. We can use words for flavor, like sweet, sour, salty. Salty wouldn't apply to honey, and sour generally wouldn't either. So sweet, sour, salty, pungent, bitter, astringent. Okay, and then you have words like tangy. What is that experience? It has to be individually experienced to be understood. It's a very individual thing, which is central teaching of Krishna consciousness, that we're all individual living beings. If you say everything is all energy, then there's no specific difference between you and me. And then there's no possibility to taste rasa, or we just take rasa, the exchange of love, to be something. It's not really there. It's just an illusion. If we say everything is just energy, then all perceptions of individuality, all perceptions of everything, is just an illusion, because who is perceiving? Just energy imagining that it's experiencing some other energy. But we are individual living beings, and perceptions are real. If you don't believe it, next time you get a toothache, just think of it. I'm not wishing toothache on anyone, but there are all kinds of aches and pains and nauseas and various physical difficulties that we all go through. And some of them are very intense. Toothache is very intense. Kidney stones, the pain is very intense. So we can say, you go to the doctor and say, kidneys. Well, let's get back to the dentist as we're, terrible pain in my teeth. Don't worry, it's all energy. Well, do something about it. And drill, take out the drill. Can you give me some anesthesia? Don't worry, it's just energy. It's all just energy. But we do individually experience pain. And it's little comfort to say, well, it's all just energy at that time. Each is an individual. We're all individual living beings. The attempt to merge everything together by some philosophical understanding, that is not at all appealing to the Vaishnavas, who want to bring out the loving exchange, who want to develop that loving exchange with Krishna. And then there are those who don't. We just heard from that Malanam Ashani verse. Malanam means the restless. They saw Krishna as a lightning bolt, whereas others saw him Smaro Murtiman, Cupid personified, the most lovable, the most lovable in a most intimate way. Just seeing him as like Cupid. So all had some general impression of Krishna. When he entered the wrestling arena, everyone noticed him. Everyone noticed him. It's just Krishna's nature to attract everyone's attention. His very name means all attractive. And those who were inimical to him, repelled by him, they all understood that this boy's going to be tough. He's going to be tough. He looks like a little boy, but he's tough. Big, huge, nasty wrestlers. They're trained to fight and win. They can kill with their hands. They can kill others very easily. What do they do when they get a toothache? Little tooth. They have to go and see Dr. Ramesh, right? Krishna doesn't get toothache, so we invite Dr. Ramesh to come and visit our temple there in Salem and see Krishna. Pain. We can talk big philosophy, but pain is a fact. Unfortunately, the whole society, the materialistic society, not just now, since time immemorial, at the present time especially, we're cut off from, we're all individual living beings. That seems like the most intuitive thing, but if you say everything's all energy, then it philosophically it denies that, although we don't stop acting like that. But if we say we're all just energy, no, we are all living beings, and individual living beings make up society. But the whole society at the present time is cut off. We're all individually cut off from our real need. We need food, we need water, we need doctors and dentists, and we need so many things in human society. But our heart's need, our deepest need, is to love. And that, we get so much education. But how to love? That education is not there. How to bring out our heart's deepest need, which is to love. That need is maybe more even than food, even than water, even than sex. The need to love, this is lacking. Even if we speak of love, it's generally misunderstood. Love means ultimately to put Krishna, the source of all love, in the center. Then we can love all living beings. That Buddha, as I was saying, many more educated Hindus like to keep a picture or a statue of Buddha. But Buddhist philosophy from the outside, although they talk, especially the Mahayana Buddhists, Mahayana Buddhism is not what Buddha taught directly, but anyway, they stress a lot on karuna, compassion. And the bodhisattvas, the Buddha, even though he should have got snuffed out by nirvana, the Buddhas come again and again and again to save others. But at the core of their philosophy, at the core of Buddhism, is that there is no soul. They don't even say everything's all energy. They don't even say there is everything. They don't even say there is anything. But specific teaching of Lord Buddha's anatma, there is no atma, there is no living being. We're not living beings. And that denies at the very outset that there is any rasa, that there is any possibility of loving exchange. And then we wonder, what is this compassion? Who's being compassionate upon whom? If there are no living beings, ultimately, Lord Buddha taught about dukkha, pain, the whole idea of Buddhism, nirvana, to attain nirvana, to stop our existence, although we don't exist anyway. But who stops to exist, and who reincarnation, who suffers, who reincarnates? The Krishna consciousness movement teaches the process of understanding clearly who we are. It's meant for the sanitization of society. And that doesn't mean going around with antiseptic swabs. It means to make society sane, to understand the obvious fact that we are living beings. We are not the chemicals of which the bodies are made, and we're not simply some waves floating around in space. We are, by nature, living, loving beings. Everywhere is energy. Everywhere is consciousness, which drives the energy. Everywhere there is desire. Desire makes the energies of living beings interact. Desire gives rise to emotion. Rasa is everywhere. Energy is everywhere. Rasa is everywhere. So this idea that everything is just energy, without further qualifying it and recognizing the source of that energy, and how we need to channel that energy or ride the waves of that energy so that we, as individual living beings, can be fully satisfied, that is completely missing in the education system, in the culture, all over the world, and therefore the whole world is becoming what is called nirvishesha shunyavadi. They don't recognize the immense importance of every living being. Eternally, we're all eternal living beings. We're just, everything is vague, energy. I'm more than just some energy. I am a living being. This we need to teach. Our spiritual master, Srila Prabhupada, was so much opposed to this impersonalism, as he called it. It denies personality. He was so much against it. He spoke so strongly against it. Sometimes you feel you want to wince. He was so strongly against this because it's such a dangerous idea, denying personality. No, the nirvishesha means there's nothing specific. Everything we see is specific, but they say, well, it's just all waves here and there. No, reality is full of specifics. Therefore, we have Ramanuja's philosophy, Vishishtadvaita, recognizing that in one sense everything is one, but see the specifics also. Don't deny the specifics. Just like in Krishna's pastimes, there are many narrations of Krishna killing so many demons, just like in the wrestling arena. Krishna came there with a specific purpose to kill the wrestlers and ultimately to kill the king of the Bhojas, the Kamsa. And he did. And he killed them. And in this way, Krishna very kindly released them from their misconceptions about him, which were causing them to suffer life after life after life. So in our Krishna Conscious Movement also, we shouldn't neglect the killing demons part. Not that we're going to go around physically killing, but this Mayavad, this idea that everything is all one, even if we say everything is all love, we have to be more specific. Love means centered on Krishna. Without being specific, if we just reduce everything to energy or some vague terms, then we're missing the reality, who is Krishna. Now, there's a whole big philosophy behind this, a whole big understanding. It's not so difficult to understand that there is a source of everything. The source is Krishna. That is accepted by all great spiritual authorities since time immemorial. But it becomes difficult to understand when we get our consciousness fuddled by vague ideas that everything is all one, everything is all energy. And again, okay, everything is all one. Yeah, in one sense. Ekam advitiyam. Everything is all one, but who is that one?